My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Helen Shaver. The career of Helen Shaver is really a story of three careers, two in front of and one behind the camera. Shaver has had acting roles in such films as Who Has Seen the Wind and Praise of Older Women, Amityville Horror, The Austrian Weekend, Desert Hearts, The Color of Money, and Bethune, The Making of a Hero, and television series like United States, Jessica Novak, WIOU, Poltergeist, The Legacy, and The Education of Max Bickford. It was for Poltergeist that she stepped behind the camera to direct several episodes, and she's become an in-demand director and has helmed series such as The Outer Limits, The OC, Judging Amy, Flashpoint, Law & Order Special Victims Unit, Combat Hospital, Revolution, Person of Interest, and Orphan Black. Her first television movie, Summer's End in 1999, was a family film starring James Earl Jones and Wendy Crewson, and was nominated for a Daytime Emmy Award for Outstanding Directing in a Children's Special. She continues her television directing efforts on this season's Vikings, which will kick off our conversation before exploring some of the art and craft of storytelling with Helen Shaver. In watching a few of the episodes this season of Vikings, and I was lucky enough to go onto the History website, and I think I watched your most recent episode that you directed. The thing that strikes me, and I think I just had a recent discussion with Dennis McGrath, who's working on X Company right now. And we were talking about the idea of history and historical television and all of that stuff. I'm curious as to when you walk into the show as a director, how do you dance that line between respecting the fact that you've essentially got a sword and battle and history kind of show, all while respecting that it is still the history of a people that you really don't make. You want to make sure that you don't screw up somehow.
To begin with, Michael Hirst who came from academia when he started, is researches and does that blend so much in the writing, and I trust that very much. It is not down to, there are certain things that I have researched, or in prep said, well, what really happened, like this is last season. What really happened when somebody found out their wife was committing adultery? And, what was the church's real most terrible punishment? And indeed, they could back it up with the fact that they cut off a nose and two ears. and then it was originally staged to happen in a dungeon. And Michael and I talked, and I said, well, the public square would be much more fantastic, and could it happen in the public square? Absolutely, it could happen in the public square. So, you make those kind of blends. In episode 404 this year, called Yol, we were looking at the Christians, the Christmas celebrations in France and England, and for the Vikings, the celebration of the winter solstice, and what would that be? And the historical facts were brought into it. What the Vikings were doing at that time of year was historical to a degree, and fantasized to a degree by me, and signed off on by the historians and by Michael. In terms of what would you do? I mean, we know that the Yule log comes from wanting to bring light into the center of darkness, and the darkest day is the solstice, and Christmas falls basically at the solstice. And so, we created a whole pageantry and ritual around bringing light to the center of the community. And, I imagined the lighting of this fire, the torches coming over the hill, the lighting of the fire, and then, creatively using a crane to pull up and up and up so that you created basically the sun in the center of darkness lit by the flames of the people, which is their hopes for spring and rebirth and all of those things that is sort of indigenous worldwide, it seems to me, coming from our primitive beginnings, when we know that in the middle of the winter, underneath the earth, in it all darkness, is life, right. And we just have to hope and wait for that life to reemerge. So, it's a wonderful conversation in history. I love working with Michael Hirst in terms of what he conceives and delivers in the script, and then in the month-long prep before you shoot for a month, there is this fabulous creative conversation that goes back and forth so that you're visually creating metaphors, visual metaphors for what is going on internally, whether that be something like Yol or whether it be something that has to do with the personal stories wound up in religion and all of those.
It sounds like, and there's also conversation, I think, that you're having with the audience about creating kind of these archetypal touchstones.
Because this is where we come from. This is where our culture comes from. And when you boil it all down, and I've always believed this to be true, as an actor, as a director, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, that I truly believe that if we can communicate the specificness of our reality, you know, individually as actors, collectively as a filmmaker. So for example, if I am a character who has lost whose baby has died inside of her 2 days before it should be born, my mourning for that child, specific to my culture, specific to my person, could be seen by someone in a completely other society, primitive or advanced, that has different traditions, different language, different religion, different everything, but the truth of that human experience is spoken through the mouthpiece of the character, but it's the truth that actor knows, that human being knows, spoken through that circumstance, that imaginary circumstance, will resonate beyond language, beyond culture. And in fact, there was a young woman doing a PhD in communications who interviewed me when I was in Ireland this past time. Mm-hmm. And she'd come to Vikings because she had been in Africa working with a very primitive group of people about imagery, and she had given them all and capturing it and given them all very rudimentary cameras, motion picture cameras,
sure.
You know, video cameras, basically digital cameras, to work with and record some things to make a story, to tell a story the way we tell stories through film, and they were all together someplace where there was electricity because they were doing an editing thing, and had some time to spare, and it occurred to her that maybe she would show them some Western film or television, and on her computer, because she loved Vikings, she had an episode of Vikings, and she showed this to these people who had, you know, I mean, the language, the culture, I mean, these people had never heard of Vikings, and they completely resonated with what was going on a, you know, it wasn't because of the dialogue, it wasn't because of the narrative, it was because of the true story underneath the story, right? Which is the human struggle, the human drama, that we universally share.
Right.
And I think that is one of the the most fantastic things about what it is we do, is that you bridge worlds.
Are there things that you want to put in frame that you don't even necessarily want to? You don't want to bash the audience over the head with them. You don't want to say, "Hey, notice this," but you know that if it's there, it's going to create a lingering impact.
I mean, and again, I'm going back because this is the one that's in my mind right now. I'm going back to not season four, but season three, where over the course of the two episodes that I do, the English princess acknowledges that she's pregnant with a child that is not her husband's child, and the audience knows that she's pregnant with Athelstan's child. Athelstan, who was a monk, who was taken as a slave by the Vikings, who became a Viking and became Ragnar's dearest friend, and who she loved very much. And by the end of the second episode of the block, Athelstan is going to be killed by Floki. You know, who represents all the shamanism and sort of the mythology of the Vikings, mm-hmm. which was in conflict with the Christian mythology. So it was written in the script that this princess is sitting in her room embroidering, and her husband comes in, and in the course of that scene, he finds out she's pregnant, wants to know who's the father. She refuses to tell. So when I was conceiving that scene, I said, well, what is she embroidering? And I decided that what she was embroidering was a little gold cross on a piece of white fabric that would end up being baby clothes for this unborn child that she was carrying. And so I set up the image of her sitting there embroidering, and I had her, the needle comes through the cloth and prick her finger, and then had her press the finger so that the little blob of blood came out, and to visually show and she uses that blood like lipstick, right, and puts her finger in her mouth to lick the blood off, and you know, which is a very sensual image. And then she, with the blood on her lips like lipstick, she kisses that cross, leaving an imprint of her lips on the cross. Because I knew that in the end, when Floki kills Athelstan, that I would have Athelstan having been sort of reborn to his Christian faith, kneeling in front of a rudimentary cross that he had made in his room, and Floki will come in and kill him in front of that cross. So without any words, the imagery connects the cross, you know, the blood, the cross, the sacrifice, all of those things that just evoke a whole other level of response, probably unconscious response from the audience. And I don't know, I'm sure some very astute people who study it would look and go, oh, that's what was being done. But it's not important for me that the audience be conscious of that's what's being set up, but rather that it resonates with them, that it rings the bell deeply, and they get it without even knowing they get it. So I like all of that stuff.
I guess that's part of the creative joy of directing, even though oftentimes now, like you said, directing, you come in for a couple of episodes a season, the scripts are already there. The touches that you can add, like you said, aren't maybe the stuff that's going to bang people over the head, but that's the stuff where if you were a musician, if you were a painter, you can take just as much joy in that subtlety in the top corner of a canvas that you can take in doing some of these small things on screen. And even if there's only the 5% of people that notice,
look at those scenes that I'm talking about, you will see that that is very much, you know, that those are the moving pictures, and you know, it it says more than, well, words say a lot, but that kind of imagery really adds a whole other layer to what the words are. It's the same as somebody can say, you know, pass the bread, and they can be saying, I love you. They can be saying, I hate you. They can be saying, I'm completely distraught and don't know what to do with myself. It's the same words, but it is the intention and the understanding of the underpinnings, the deep underpinnings of the story underneath the narrative, right? Because there's always a plot, and the plot is what's there, but it's the real story underneath that is what keeps people coming back, and is the story that is of great interest as an artist. I mean, that's the poetry, that's the magic, I think. And like I say, the wonderful part about working with Michael Hirst is that he's very, very collaborative and communicative and open to this creative process. You know, he's secure in his work and his vision, so that he is open to sort of a yes and,
right,
as opposed to no, that's, I didn't think of that, you know, which is how, of course, there are some people in the world that work. So that's it keeps me coming back to do Vikings because of that creative process. I mean, yeah, there's so many elements in Vikings that are in doing Vikings that are exciting as a director. It is extraordinary art department, a great, you know, world-class camera department. The actors are fabulous to work with. I mean, it is a great experience doing Vikings.
When you first stepped on the set, and because it's such a show of epic scale, did it take a little bit to say to yourself, I've got to get through this one episode storyline without necessarily letting myself get swept up in the fact that I've got these elements of saga and scale and legend that I have to deal with? Did it take a little while, or was it easy for you to just hunker down and say, this is the script, let's make sure that we get through it?
Oh, no, it's not at all like that for me.
Okay.
I don't even recognize that person you're talking about. The scope of the story is part of what attracts me, is to be able to open it up and breathe and expand to the epic scale, you know, and to play with archetypes and to play with great deep imagery on scale, you know, both in its largeness and in the intimate scenes. Like, you know, this year with Diane Donen and Travis Fimmel, I got to tell this fantastic story of the king and the slave, you know, that is a love story and a story of power and intrigue and obsession and addiction and surrender and intimacy and you know, and so I, you know, the it's epic on a whole other level. You know, it's one thing when you're out with all the boats and you know, doing a big battle scene or pageantry. That's one kind of epic, but the other kind of epic is this human interaction and a desire to connect and the ability to trust and surrender and all of those elements of humanity.
The universal themes that are like we talked about earlier, in as much as we talked about visual archetypes, there are thematic archetypes too that all of us kind of resonate with.
Absolutely. Plus, you know, in that story, she has this Chinese medicine, this betel nut, you know, which is an amphetamine kind of drug, and she, for her own reasons, some of which are benign, some of which are more intriguing than benign, she seeks to ease his psychic and emotional pain by giving him this drug. And so I got to create, you know, imagine and then create a trip, you know, a drug trip,
right.
Which was really fun. Having had done my investigation of that part of life in an earlier I come to it well prepared, like anybody of my generation.
I'm curious, maybe we can use that as a segue, because I'd love to take this opportunity to talk to you. I think you come to this interview with such a unique perspective on television and film, not only in front of the camera, but from behind the camera. And I'm wondering if, I know this is going to be kind of an open-ended question, but maybe in terms of just some reflections on, you know, what you're shooting a very specific type of television right now, and you also were on a whole bunch of television shows. I look back on the IMDb page, which is kind of like the online Bible, and I see credits for you like The Beachcombers and King of Kensington and all of these early Canadian classics. I'm wondering if you can maybe ruminate on just a little bit about the difference between television as it was you know, back in the early 70s versus television now, and kind of maybe a couple of the things that strike you most in your mind as maybe some of the good things that have happened and some of the bad things that have happened.
That is a very open-ended question. I mean, I my experience as an actor brings me, you know, to the table, first of all, not fearing actors, which I think a lot of people, because they don't understand the process, though there's a lot of people who I think are afraid of actors, You know, and anyway, so I am not.
Right.
I get the process, and I love my actors, and I know that the greatest thing that you can, one of the greatest things you can do as a director is create an atmosphere where people can make mistakes.
Sure.
Because it's only in our willingness to, you know, sort of take the ride, to abandon ourselves to the moment and actually be in the moment that that true greatness happens. I mean, if you're a skilled actor, you know, with or without a director, it's going to be fine. You'll do something, and it'll be fine.
Right.
But I don't get up in the morning for fine. And most people who make films do not get up in the morning to do fine. We all come each day to work with the desire to create and to co-create. And so certainly my experience, I've worked with some of the world's greatest directors, Martin Scorsese, Sam Peckinpah, John Schlesinger, Donna Dee. I mean, I've worked with some of the greatest directors in the world. I've also worked with some of the most mediocre and some of the worst. And one of the huge differences is whether an environment is created on the set. And I'm not talking about some sycophant environment, because there's no need for that. That's just a hallmark of fear, really, when somebody's being a sycophant.
Right.
But to truly create an atmosphere where everyone wants to give their best performance, because it has to be given, and it needs to be given to someone, and there needs to be safety and comfort in the environment so that can be given. So, you know, I mean, I don't know about the evolution of television and all of that, because, you know, as all of this has evolved, I've gone from being a 21-year-old to being a 65-year-old. So so a lot of what has changed is also my own maturation. But I believe we are in the golden age of television, where the long stories of character and mythology can truly be told. So many films nowadays are, I mean, they're epic. They're not actors' films.
Right.
And television is really these days the place for actors, which is why you see everybody doing it. I don't know. Does that satisfy?
It does.
I know that one of my great pleasures is being able at this point in my life and my creative arc it's so wonderful to be able to take my experience, whether it be technical and practical or whether it be as a human being, and in 25 words or less, be able to communicate something essential to the actor or to the cinematographer or to the, you know, to the editor or to the, you know, because direction is not simply standing on a set saying, oh, could you do that again and be funnier on that line, or, you know, I mean, that's not what it is about. It is about creating this world where all of these people who are so expert in their own areas are willing to come and give their best and accepting the responsibility of being the storyteller, so that you direct all of that greatness towards the essence of what you're trying to achieve in that moment. And I mean, it's quite an amazing thing that 150 people and some machines over and over and over again during the day can bring their attention and their expertise to these moments, you know, 3 and 4 moments at minutes at a time, and these little, you know, these pearls get created, and then you string these pearls together to make a necklace, and it's fantastic. It is truly one of the great experiences, and I know that my years of acting and all my experiences of being on sets well run, poorly run, you know, give me the understanding and experience to do that and do it well. Not always perfectly. I learn every day. I mean, you get scared every time it's the night before you're going to shoot your first shot on something new. It's marvelous to say print the first time every time, you know, but it also gives me the experience to trust that it will come, you know, it will, and the patience to stay. I mean, the great waste of time is to leave a scene before you've got it.
Right.
You know, then you have wasted 3 hours.
Yeah. Was there a time that you thought of yourself as a director first and foremost instead of an actor? Did you make that transition at some point where if someone asks you now, you know, are you a director, are you an actor, do you still consider yourself both? Or do you now identify as, hey, I'm a director?
I identify as a director who is also an actor.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I you can't ever not be an, you know, I am what I am. it's like a mother with two children.
Right.
You know, you're not just the mother of one child, you're the mother of both, and your experience is both.
I'm curious, I'm looking back over the past, just over the past 3 or 4 years, and there's this wide range of television shows and skipping over a whole bunch of different genres. And I'm curious, I'm assuming a lot of people may think that, you know, it's a 7 to 10 day shoot and therefore a director walks in and it's a 7 to 10 day thing. But I mean, you've talked about the idea that you're probably dealing with probably about a month to 2 months worth of prep work.
Particularly, you shoot in blocks, so a 2-episode block. So you prep for 22 days, which is, you know, you're not counting weekends, so that's
sure.
a month.
Yep.
And then you shoot for 22 days.
Okay.
So that's another month. And then you have a rest for a few days, and then you go into editing for about 2 weeks. So all in all, it's nearly 3 months that you spend with the material. And you know, I mean, now doing something like Person of Interest, that is usually an 8-day prep and then a 10 or 11 day shoot.
Okay.
And you know, that's a whole other kettle of fish. It's a different, it's a very, you know, it's very different subject matter. It's all over New York. It's wild and woolly. you know, if you change locations 3 times during the day in Manhattan, that's a busy, busy day, you know?
Sure.
And but again, you're dealing with very big current items, you know, like in terms of, is Big Brother watching? What does that all mean, you know? And how are the human beings and all of that stuff? And Orphan Black is a... again, it's about an 8-day prep and, you know, a 9-day shoot generally, something like that, for 1 hour, unless you're doing 2, and then it changes up. But, and I love Orphan Black also. I mean, Graham Manson and John Fawcett, fantastic to work with, and all the actors are great on that show, like Vikings, and as the central characters, Tatiana is just like breathtaking. So, yeah, it's a and the prep is, you know, is this wonderful time to you're constantly making choices and the choices direct you in different ways. You're committing to locations, you're committing to casting, you're committing to costuming, you're committing to props. You're making a lot of choices. A schedule is being built while you're prepping, and that you're in dialogue with your AD who is building the schedule to say, no, I know that scene looks simple like this, but I actually need this amount of time because I want to go out and see the broad thing, and you know, it's so you're forming. It is really measure twice, cut once. You know, you're really forming the skeleton on which you're going to. Which you're going to flesh out with the doing, with the actual making of the shooting. And then you go into the editing room, And there, of course, there's a whole other iteration of the story as you choose which moments you emphasize. You open up space for the audience to have time to reflect on the moment, or you take out pause to pick up the pace and drive them towards something else. All of which you have also been aware of and shot. Use the camera in both framing and movement to give you the material that, when cut together, will, you know, create the tension, create, you know, whatever it is you're trying to do in that moment.
Right.
So it's a fabulous, multi-layered, you know, it's three-dimensional chess. It's great fun.
As I'm looking over some of the stuff that you've directed over the past 10 years or so, a question which popped into my mind was, and I'm hoping you might have some perspective on this as well, is it seems like reflecting back to, you know, I grew up as a child of the 70s, watching a lot of 70s television shows, and the one thing that I will say about the time is that while I enjoyed so many of the shows from that time, the one thing that was clearly lacking was diversity, not only with regards to culture, but with regards to gender. Have we made at least a few steps at this point with regards to some kind of gender equity in terms of at least having strong female role models as leads on shows? I think we still have a long way to go with culture, but at least with regards to gender, have we made some steps with that?
In terms of in front of the camera, I think we are making steps, although it's still abysmal.
Yes.
You know, it's still shockingly... You know, it's shockingly imbalanced still,
sure.
But I think that is moving in the right direction. I mean, way back when, let me see, this would be like 1980 or something, maybe 81. I was chosen to do the lead in a television series for CBS. A short-lived series called Jessica Novak, which was about an on-air television news reporter, was Jessica Novak, and I was Jessica Novak. And at that time, it was the first hour that would ever be carried by a woman who was not a woman in Jeopardy.
Wow.
You know, I mean, and not a soap opera.
Sure.
And you know, so that's 1980, and then we move through, you know, and certainly, yes, absolutely, huge steps have been made in that area, you know, diversity in terms of, you know, racial and diversity in front of the camera is improving, and the
LGBTQ?
Yes, community is being... more represented, but behind the camera, you know, in terms of, particularly in terms of directors, it is still shockingly, one woman director a year, maybe.
Right.
I still walk onto sets and am told, "Oh my God, a woman." Oh, you're directing, you know.
It's sad. It's sad that we're laughing at that, but I believe you because I've talked to so many people on this podcast now that are echoing the same idea. And unfortunately, there's nothing that's being done about it.
I'm really glad that, although certainly, I mean, I've been aware of all of this over the years. I have, you know, I've sort of had eyes ahead because one spent one's time thinking about that. You wouldn't get out of bed, right?
Right.
You just wouldn't. And I mean, you know, I was in my, I think I was 47 or something when I started directing. So, you know, I had ageism and the fact that I was a woman and that I'd been an actor, all sort of standing as strikes against, I suppose, in the sort of classic North American way. But so I certainly did not, thank God I didn't concentrate or even think about those things at the time. I just went, okay, this is what I want to do. All right, what do I have to do? Okay, I'll do Poltergeist, The Legacy, which was a series that I didn't want to act in particularly. But that was the way that I could leverage directing. And the other thing, I got this award recently from Women's Image Network for a Vikings that I directed for The Usurper. But and when I was thinking about, you know, if I were to win, what did I want to say, you know, aside from my thank yous to Michael Hirst and the cast and everybody for the great material and experience of doing. But and what I realized when I was thinking about it was that I was 33 and a half years old, having starred in a few television series myself, having done movies and commercials and guest appearances on episodes and all of those things, and plays, when I did Desert Hearts, when I accepted Desert Hearts, that was the first time that I ever even met a female director.
Right.
You know, so times have changed. That was 1984. So times are indeed changing. But you kind of go, you know,
I know.
How long does this change take? You know, here in Canada, of course, Trudeau, when he was elected and formed his cabinet, did a 50-50 gender split, and when asked why, he said, it's 2016. That's why. Well, it's actually 2015 when he said it's 2015. Enough said, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's certainly a need for us to move along now. Come on, let's go.
I'm just curious to wrap up each episode. One of the things I usually ask people, because I always love to reflect back on what my kind of pop culture touchstones were during my formative years as I was growing up. I'm curious, what were kind of the influential television and film and music on you as during the formative years, as you were thinking to yourself, I want to be an actor, I want to be involved in this? Were there television shows that you always watched? Were there films that you fell in love with? All of that stuff.
Well, when I was a little girl, we didn't have a television until I was 11.
Okay.
We had books and we had pianos, and we went to the movies. You know, I remember going to see Ben-Hur and My Fair Lady, and in the little town that I grew up in, back in the day when I was in grade school, there would be, you know, double bills at the Saturday matinee, and so I remember. I mean, I always loved film, but I never thought about being an actor or a director in those days. I was always. I spent a lot of time in the hospital when I was a child, and so I was very familiar with my imaginary worlds, because when you can't get out of bed and you're in the same room for 3, 4, 5, 6 months at a time, you know, your imagination is free to roam and create whatever realities you want for yourself, and using books to platform and jump off of, or just whatever.
Right.
I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and back in the day, the high mass with all its, you know, ritual and theatrics absolutely moved me. But it was, I was 16 and had changed from the Catholic school to the, the regular public school, this new high school that had been built that had a stage in it. Now, back in those days, there were no theater classes or anything like that. And I was terrified to stand up in front of a class and read out loud. I never really liked to do that. Our homeroom teacher formed a drama club, and my best friend and I joined with no intention of acting or anything like that. We were going to build sets and do costumes or whatever. And he was very, very persistent and insistent, although I said no many times, at me auditioning for this play by Elaine May called Not Enough Rope. Anyway, through his insistence, he kept me after school, and I read the monologue out loud a few times for him until finally the words were going in my eyes, jumbling around inside of me and falling out of my mouth as if they were my own words. And I did that play and found out that it was always terrifying to the moment before you stepped onto the stage, but that once I was on the stage, it brought me completely into the present, and and there was such, oh, I don't know, I just felt like I was alive like no other time in my life and free. And so that began my journey. And then as I got older, wonderful films like The Devils of Loudun or I don't know, all those great films in the late 60s, early 70s, in which very human stories were told, you know, some mythical, but oftentimes just really ordinary, wonderful stories, right. Like what? Midnight Cowboy,
sure.
And when I started seeing Scorsese's films, and by then I was an actor, and I sort of accepted the fact that I was an actor when I was 21 after I had tried to quit and go to nursing school because I thought the world, I was afraid, really, is what I was, but I didn't know it at the time, and I thought the world didn't need another actor. And on my 21st birthday, I got up and quit school, and by the end of the day, I had an acting job. And so, you know, I can't really... And then as it went along, I have always, when I've read a script, well, not all scripts, some scripts I read them and I go, yeah, whatever. But if it resonates with me, I see the movie or I see a movie when I read the script, and then, you know, that movie evolves as I read it more and more, and you go into rehearsal and all of that as an actor. And sometimes when I would see the movie the director had made, I would be thrilled, and sometimes I'd think, well, they missed the point of that entirely, from my perspective. And so that evolved to where finally in the mid-90s, in talking to a woman who I was going to start working with as a manager, she kept saying, well, but Helen, can you just tell me what it is you want? And, you know, I'm a good Canadian girl born in 51, and wanting is not what you're supposed to do. It's kind of impolite, right? And so after many kind of, oh, I want to work with good people, and she kept bottom lining me, what do you want? What do you want? I heard myself say then, I want to be a director. And she said, okay, now we have a five-year plan. And indeed, by the end of that 5 years, we were picking up the Emmy for best daytime, well, it was a daytime Emmy for best all-ages film, a film I'd done for Showtime called Summer's End, and I was nominated for Best Director, and James Earl Jones won the award for Best Actor, and, you know, so it was it wasn't easy,
right.
but it was manifest. I was lucky enough to make the transition. Airplane going over.
That's okay.
There you go.
And you get to keep you get to keep telling stories right up until this day on a show like Vikings.
Right. Well, and that's the deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the other thing about Vikings, I mean, led by the really, really stunning Travis Fimmel and like Linus Roche, and I mean, this is and Catherine. I mean, this is an extraordinary group of actors who have really embraced the world and their characters and who work so diligently and bring themselves so faithfully to the material. It is really one of the most impressive things I've ever been involved in.
Thanks to Helen Schaefer for talking with me about Vikings and a long career, not only in front of but behind the camera, just some incredible titles and things that you remember and roles that you remember and shows that you remember. And I would suspect that a lot of you didn't know that she was involved in directing as much as many of you might have remembered her for acting roles, but didn't know she was directing as much. So hopefully after listening to our conversation, you learned a little bit more about Helen Schaefer and some of the incredible work that she continues to do on television with some of the biggest shows, quite frankly, that are being made in Canada today, and not only Canada, but in the States as well. It was certainly a pleasure to talk to her. You can listen to all the past episodes of this podcast by going to tv-eh.com.
clicking on podcasts. If you want to support us, please go to our Patreon site, Patreon. If you're interested, you can always listen to the stuff for free, but if you want to kick us a couple bucks at patreon.com/TV_EH, we would certainly appreciate it. Helps keep, you know, the summer's coming up and the air conditioning's got to keep going, or else the servers are going to crash and all of a sudden the world economy is going to collapse or something like that. You can find TVA on Twitter at TV_EH. You can find all the other podcasts that I do at AnthonyMarco.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.